At the turn of the 20th century, Scotland's largest town was booming. It was a hive of industry where more than 10,000 people worked every day, making a product used the world over.
Spools of red thread.
We exported thread to the whole world.
At one stage, they produced 90% of the world's sewing threads.
For more than 100 years, the thread mills were the life and soul of the town of Paisley.
Paisley was thread and thread was Paisley, you know. And there was hardly a house in Paisley didn't have somebody that was employed by the mills.
Thread built the town and provided its people with once-in-a-lifetime opportunities.
It is one of the very first industrial multinational companies.
The company sent their workers far and wide.
You had Germany, Brazil, Asia, India, Pakistan, you know.
Yeah, the people going to these countries that nobody would ever have dreamt of being able to go to.
Where they often witnessed life-changing events.
So my father, he saw life under the Nazis in Germany.
We had two military coups while we were there.
But the glory days weren't to last, and eventually boom became bust.
It was just so sad.
It was devastating.
It was a sad, sad day for Paisley.
I think it devastated the town, because what were you left with?
A thin strand of thread is unwound from an animated bobbin to form Paisley's skyline. The town that thread built.
100 years ago, Benjamin Disraeli came out with the immortal phrase, "Keep your eye on Paisley." Prime ministers knew what they were talking about in those days, for this is no ordinary town.
Until the 1980s, the town of Paisley had two huge mill complexes. At their height, they were the town's largest employer.
It's the biggest town in Scotland, if you don't count the cities. It was the thread capital of the world for 150 years.
Professor Sam McKinstry.
The thread industry became immensely important to Paisley because it employed 11 to 12,000 people, which is a huge number for a town of about 70,000 inhabitants.
Ken Matheson, cost accountant.
We used to run a book. The bet was on what colour the river would be today. Some days it was bright yellow, some days it was purple, some days it was black. Every day it was a different colour. It was quite a surprise when there was no colour at all.
The mills stopped here forever in 1993, but the people who worked in them have long memories.
This stretch along here was the Atlantic and Pacific, Clark's Originals Mills. And just at the trees here was the wee first aid station, which is gone. You still run in there for an orange drink when you got a cold.
Harry Green began his career in the thread mills as an office boy in 1949 and ended up as an assistant manager.
We are looking at the Mile End finishing mill. I ended my career in here in 1983 after having completed 34 years with J&P Coats. That included starting in the head office in Glasgow and finishing the mills in Paisley, where it all began many, many years ago.
Harry enters the imposing mill building. Inside, he walks through a door into an empty corridor and takes a look around.
Whew, good grief. What a change. Well, from what I remember, we used to come down West Road and go in the turning shop gate along to my mill. Then I was up in the top flat in there, and then that's the counting house.
This is the counting house at Ferguson Mills, and this is where I started work when I was 15. The last time I would be in the counting house would probably be about 1973-ish.
Eleanor Clark worked in the mill for 39 years. Her jobs included personnel manager and editing the company newspaper. She began her career as an office junior in this building, which has been converted into flats.
I can't believe this. No, it's quite unrecognisable. So different.
These buildings are amongst a very few that remain of what was once an enormous presence in the town.
Number 8 Twisting and the Gatehouse.
That was the main gatehouse, the North Gatehouse. The day I arrived, I came down, I came through that arch, and this girl came through and said she would take me, and she brought me up here.
Oh, there's a chimney. There's a chimney there.
Harry walks to a window and looks out at the tall chimney stack.
Now, from my office, I could see up to the top of the chimney, and there was a hawk nested up there for years.
Harry turns from the window and walks away as the sun bathes the red brick mill in its warm glow. A man crosses a footbridge over the river in the shadow of the mill building.
The mills provided jobs for the people of Paisley, known as buddies, for generations.
Everywhere you went, everybody you met, you worked in the mill? I remember you, worked in the mill. I mean, everybody knew where you worked at that time.
David McInally.
I started in 1956 in the mills. I was 15 years old, and I started in a department called the turning shop. The turning shop made the wooden bobbins. There was possibly about 80 boys, all between the ages of 15 to 20. You grew up quick there.
I had been told by my mother to apply to get into Coates office. That was the thing to do.
It was my mum that put the idea into my head. She says, well, we've all worked in the mill. What about you? Why not going to the mill?
When I get interviewed, I get sent for to say that as soon as I had left school, I could start on the Monday. So my mother said, well, that's fine, you can start this Monday.
I started off as a management trainee with Coates immediately after university. And there was definitely a feeling that when you joined, you were joining for life.
I remember a friend of my mum say, oh, Jean, she said, that's just set for life when you're an accountant house in the mill.
I joined Coates in 1974, straight out of university. I am the great-great-great-grandson of James Coates Sr., who was the original founder of the first factory, the father of J&P Coates.
The Paisley Thread Mills would ultimately be run by one large company, J&P Coates, but their origins lay in a decades-long rivalry between two prominent Paisley families, the Coates and the Clarks.
They were fierce rivals, one at one end of Paisley and one at the other end.
Paisley had long been a textile town, and the area's weavers had risen to prominence making intricate silk shawls with that unique pattern which came to bear the town's name.
Paisley pattern, it was the predominant motif on the Paisley shawls, and the Paisley shawl was internationally famous. It was a very complex cloth, so it required a very high level of skill. And Paisley, because it already had a well-established weaving industry, they were able to take on this industry.
Both the Coates and the Clarks worked in the weaving trade. And although ultimately it would be the Coates family who came out on top, in the early days, the Clarks were the innovators.
Many people tried to make a cotton sewing thread, but with no success for years and years and years. And the Clarks, who were the brilliant family, although as a Coates I'm reluctant to say this, but it's true, they happened upon it because of Napoleon's blockade of the UK in 1806.
The Napoleonic Wars had shut down trade between Britain and France, leaving the weavers of Paisley without their most crucial raw material, silk. The Clarks made their living providing silk twine to weavers. The blockade threatened their livelihood, but it also presented them with an opportunity.
There was no way for them to continue providing this product because it wasn't available anywhere within the UK. so they tried to make a substitute.
It was the early days of the Industrial Revolution, and the textile industry was reaping the benefits of new machinery.
And the way of making cotton yarn had been revolutionized.
So then a huge abundance of very fine cotton yarn became available to the weavers.
In spite of the blockade, Britain was managing to import some raw cotton from the colonies. The Clarks realized that this was the solution to their problem.
So they were able to happen upon a stronger, smoother product, no different really from sewing thread. So they logically started selling some cotton sewing thread just to what they called their more adventurous customers.
Within a decade of the Clarks creating the first cotton sewing thread, more than 20 thread-making companies had sprung up in the town.
The thread had initially been a producer industry to be turned into something else. It became the end product, a consumer business.
The invention of cotton sewing thread coincided with the arrival of one of the most significant domestic innovations of the 19th century.
Sewing machines.
Bingo, the sewing machine appears, and hallelujah, it's all time to get rich and happy. And indeed, both the Clarks and the Coates prospered enormously from the invention of the sewing machine.
The advent of the sewing machine meant the demand for thread was huge and growing.
The thread business just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
A statue of Sir Peter Coates.
The rival families were quick to establish their positions in town. To the east, the Clarks built their first mill in 1817, known as Anchor. The Coates family followed suit in 1826, constructing their first mill southwest of town at Fergusley. At their height, both sites grew to more than 50 acres each.
It looked like a whole town. I mean, Fergusley Mill was massive.
You'd probably have about 10 football pitches in there.
And I used to think, it's massive. Mm. Absolutely massive. You were a wee dot compared to all these people.
A convoy of vans.
Each site had multiple buildings with different functions, such as dyeing and spinning. In the largest mills, whole floors, or flats as they were known, were dedicated to winding, twisting, packaging and polishing. And there was a healthy rivalry between the workers at either end of town.
Fergusley started off with the bales of cotton right through till the twisted thread, and then Anchor finished off, and the ladies in the Anchor used to think that they were a wee bit upper than the ladies from Fergusley.
They were the tops in Anchor. We were the plebs. That's true. Yes, that's true.
This is now the biggest thread-making concern in the United Kingdom. Over 4,000 people are employed in this Paisley mill.
I'd never heard noise like it in my life.
Smelly, dirty, oily, greasy.
And it was as if the whole war had started on the one building with the noise of these machines.
The mill's spinning and winding machines.
Really noisy. Clackety clack.
Just a kind of clack, 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 clack. I think because of the noise, you were more inclined to watch people's mouths.
The lip read, you know.
You were here with this thing going round like a windmill, and the girl in front of you, she'd mouth.
They always talked it. They're back to the supervisor because some of them used to lip read too, you know.
I was only in the job about a month, and I heard a scream, and you could hear it above the machines, and it was this girl that had got the hair caught in the thing and took her scalp off the side. So all the machines stopped then. You didn't want to know about it because the next time it could be you.
A woman picks up a pile of cotton wool, then spools of thread are produced on a large hydraulic machine.
People are not very conscious of thread. They think about fashion, But this is only one of the industries we serve. And in any case, who notices the thread in a gorgeous dress?
We often forget how important thread is because we don't see it.
The fibres go through a number of processes. They're opened, carded, drawn and spun.
People never think about thread. It just holds your clothes together. But yes, there are special threads like the thread you put into baseballs, meat tying thread, tampon thread, teabag thread, things you never think about.
Look, 8 slivers are drawn into this machine to make one and to even out differences between them.
There was a great slogan that the Coats did at one time, which is imagine a world without thread.
Now look. Oh, now what's going on?
My apron and tea towel have just disappeared.
Oh.
Various items vanish.
Yes, it's an important product which everybody takes for granted.
Modern spinning and winding machines are mostly looked after by girls.
The Paisley Mills were built and owned by eminent men, but from their very beginnings, they were powered by the women and girls of Paisley. At one time, the town was said to have 7 women for every man.
Well, initially, the people who produced and worked in the machines were all ladies, and the men were like engineering associates like that, servicemen as I was doing.
You wouldn't have men spinning, for example, that was a woman's job. Children did the sort of ancillary services, the sort of support services of mending threads and things like that. But women were the main workforce by the early 20th century, and the men primarily were overseers.
The foreman was always a man, yeah. And that was basically it, the foreman was a man.
It was kind of a macho company because women only got so far. But thread would not have been made without women because it was all women that made it.
Workers leaving the mill.
Throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, the sound of the mill siren would send thousands of mill girls onto the streets. Today, the last of them are long since retired.
Well, I actually started with the intention of only working for 3 months to buy a bigger caravan.
Joyce, Josephine, Gina and Ellen all work together in Fergusley Mills and have been friends for more than 40 years.
It was the size of everything when I walked in. Massive, and I felt tiny. And I thought, gosh, am I to work in here? Will they find me again? But this nice man came up and said to me, start here. And there I was. And I felt as tall as they beams. I felt great.
We made our own wages. We were doffers, so we were in piecework.
A doffer's job was to remove the spools of thread from spindles once they were fully wound.
Speed was essential, but so was your tension, because if your tension wasn't accurate, then all the ends went up in the air and you were in trouble.
This group of women worked the twilight shift. What they earned was based solely on the amount of thread they processed.
Piecework was where if your machines were running, so was your pay.
Women who were unmarried that were in piecework because they could make more than their husbands in the jobs they were outside.
In the past, women had to leave their jobs to marry, with only single women allowed to work in the mills, giving us the word spinster. It was only later that some jobs were deemed appropriate for married women.
Well, we know that, you know, just after the First World War, half of all women working in Paisley are working in textiles, which gives you a sense of how large an employer it was and how crucial it was to the economy of Paisley in that time. You would have had high unemployment among men, especially in the 1930s after the Depression. So, you know, women's employment was important in keeping families afloat.
I enjoyed my independence, and I gave
me that. I was so excited at the thought that I could go to work. And I love the independence it gave me, having my own money instead of my husband's money in my hand.
Your wage from the mill was a lifeline at times.
Aye, that's right.
Actually, your wages from the mill built Paisley. I mean, we got hospitals and we could look at the buildings that these men built because
they had nothing else but money.
But they earned money because we worked.
In the 19th century, as the Paisley thread industry grew, so the rivalry between the two family businesses intensified.
The Coateses, because they were managerially more adept and more dedicated to quality than the Clarks, simply took over and dominated the trade very quickly, so that by 1840 they were the largest manufacturer of cotton thread in Paisley.
Although successful, the Clark family were known to be a fractious bunch, giving the far more unified Coateses the edge. James and Peter, the J and P of the company name, looked after logistics and accounting respectively, but two of their younger brothers also took key roles within the company.
Thomas, who was my great-great-grandfather, was an engineer, and Andrew was an entrepreneur and a lawyer. He didn't really join the company business at all, but he was the engine that made it work.
Andrew Coates was absolutely indispensable.
Andrew Coates sailed to America in 1839 to seek his fortune. The family business had already begun selling to the American market, but it would be his intervention which would be the making of J&P Coates.
There were people who tried to copy their product, pretending it was theirs, and Andrew Coates fought these cases in the law courts of the United States.
He took the company from a point where they were selling 45% of their product in the USA, which was with their agents, to 10 years later selling up to 85%.
Thread is wound.
In the 1850s, the Americans introduced high import taxes. The time had come for Coates to begin making thread abroad. Their Paisley rivals, the Clarks, beat them to it, building mills in New Jersey in 1866. But Coates went far behind and soon after established what would be the first of many foreign mills in the state of Rhode Island.
A large mill building.
Today, almost all of Coates' former mills in the town of Pawtucket are still standing.
Oh, boy. This is huge.
Brian Coates, the great-great-great-grandson of the company's founder, has never seen them before.
On this side, we have the first phase with mills 2, 3, and 4.
Industrial historian Matt Kierstead has agreed to give him a tour.
We are on about a 50-acre, you know, I would call it a campus or even a small industrial city.
That's close to the size of their original Fergusley Mill in Scotland at its height.
Yeah.
This is an illustrated brochure which I pulled out of the archives, and I have got a map that they did when they originally built it. So number one mill must have been where that extension has been built there, which must have been built at a later time.
Although the American site quickly grew to be as large as the one at Fergusley, production here started small, with just one building spooling thread imported from Paisley.
And you can start to see now on the backside of these buildings the attached engine room. The boilers and the steam engine would have been in there, and then in that little connecting building would have been a belt drive or shafts.
I now see this is... it's similar in size to Fergusley.
In those early years, these vast buildings were mostly staffed with skilled workers from the UK, with adverts placed in newspapers in Paisley, promising a new life in a new country.
They walk into the old mill.
I mean, my first impression of this is that it's a taller roof, and it's lighter than anything I saw in Paisley.
So each of these now empty bays would just be full of machines with little aisles for the operatives to service them.
So these were roving frames, and they would run in that direction, and the shafts that drove them would be up going that way across the roof. But that's what it would look like. Mm. And it would be extremely noisy.
Yes.
Extremely noisy.
Photos of the mill's machines, then the empty factory floor as it is today.
Just got a glimpse of Fergusley before it was all knocked down. And I always wanted to go back and look at it with a little bit more of the wisdom of age, let's put it that way. It's nice to be able to see buildings that look, they're not the same, but they're similar, and the scale is very similar. You start to imagine what it must have been like when there were people in them and the machines were all running. And I would have enjoyed being a fly on the wall and just seeing what it looked like. So, yeah, it gives me kind of goosebumps.
Within 20 years of being built, Coates American Mills had become one of the largest manufacturing plants in the United States.
Basically, the United States was a kind of a cash register for the wider organization.
The success of the American enterprise was a huge turning point for the company. Expansion into Europe came next, and manufacturing abroad set them on the path to world domination.
A lot of the money that was made in that way was invested in Paisley.
Footage of thread being produced is projected onto the window of a house.
The Coates and Clark families became very rich out of this, but they were also very public-spirited. A lot of their money went into civic buildings and the community in Paisley. It was the making of the town.
Driving through the streets of Paisley, past its various grand buildings, a domed ceiling inside the Paisley Museum and Art Gallery, then the expansive interior of Anchor Mill, Professor McKinstry.
You just cannot deny the scale and scope of Coates' generosity. Everywhere you look in Paisley, it's there. It's there in the Clark Memorial Town Hall. It's in the mills. It's there in Coates Memorial Church. What a wonderful edifice that is, to elevate the minds of the people of Paisley in the town in which they lived.
Sir Peter Coates, he built the Paisley Museum and the library. Thomas, his brother, my great-great-grandfather, built the observatory.
The building we're sitting in, the observatory, which is the major feature of the skyline of Paisley coming from the north. The individual buildings are at lowest good quality, at the best or exceptional quality, and they're designed to fit in with each other.
The exterior of the museum, with four large frontal columns, the St. George's Gate Building and the Coates Memorial Church, bells inside a tall clock tower.
The Coates and the Clarks were socially minded employers, known for their paternalism, and it wasn't just buildings they invested in, it was people too.
Way back, their welfare was incredible. They even had penny baths for people in the days when people wouldn't have baths in their house, you know.
Both mills had first aid centres, which was very good for teen sympathy. And if you wanted to know the local news, you went to first aid centre.
I applied to join the auxiliary fire service that JMP Coates had, and they supplied you with a house. So for a young 21-year-old like myself, my wife, to get something like this for the princely sum of £5 a month rent.
Both in Fergusley and Anchors, they had day sports grounds. I played hockey there. I played hockey until I was 37.
They had very successful cricket teams, football teams. There were two thriving bowls clubs.
They had sewing classes and they had keep fit classes.
There was a thriving drama club.
Put on a show every year. That was fun.
A film entitled Fergus Isle Mills Outing to Inverness, July 1936. People smile and wave.
Every year they would have an annual outing, which was a fantastic undertaking. 10,000 people moving. They would hire whole trains to take people off to places like Braemar or Arbroath or wherever it might be.
They gather outside a large building.
They had bands, and there's a fabulous photograph of them all, you know, with the moustaches and whatnot.
It was the central focus of Paisley social life.
Well, you had night outs, you know, you had to go to the Anchor, right? It was a good place.
The Anchor Recreation Club was the hub of the mill workers' social life.
And they had dances every Saturday night. And my brother and I, started a band and called it Maverick, and we played over there, and the guys were talking about going to London to try and get famous, if you like, and but I stopped it, and a certain guy called Jerry Rafferty took my place. I personally didn't like him. I didn't think he was very good. Shows you how much I know.
A photo of the recreation club. In the present day, Harry's walking towards the building.
This is the Anchor Recreation Club. I met my wife to be here. Our brother and the rest of our friends always had to make her a dance in the first half. There were six of us, so she got 12 dances in the night, at least. And it was teetotal in those days. So as you go into the main reception, the bar was across there, and it was office of drinks. You could get crisps later on at night, but not to start with at 7:30. Then 10 o'clock, you're all out, doors are shut. Great memories, great place. Those were the days.
Harry stands outside the club for a moment, then walks away.
Right from the start, the Coates family were known as good employers who valued the well-being of their workers. In 1887, Coates built a school for their young female employees. It was known as the Half-Time School.
Basically, what this is all about is if you've got a healthy workforce, they'll work harder. So it's couched in terms of, you know, employee welfare, but really it's to improve the efficiency of the business.
I mean, they were very clear that they were doing well because they had good people, and the more they looked after people, the more return they got for their businesses.
At that time, young children who were working, 12, 13, 14-year-old, had to spend time at school. Most of them would walk. And so, rather than lose that time, Coates thought it would be a good idea to have a school on the premises where people could go. And they had full-time teachers, they had nursing facilities.
Today, the once magnificent Half-Time School building lies in ruins. But from the time it opened in 1887 until the introduction of compulsory full-time education, thousands of young mill girls passed through its doors.
The remains of the school behind a locked gate.
Both Coates and Clarks had continued to expand. But the late 19th century was a time of great turmoil. Faced with strikes and recession, merger became inevitable. In 1896, the two great Paisley rivals finally agreed to join forces.
Archive film of Thread being mass-produced.
The new company, now known as J&P Coates, was the largest thread manufacturer in the world.
I would maintain that it is one of the very first industrial multinational companies. Yes, there are East India Company and so on, which are essentially trading companies, but Coates was manufacturing overseas from a very early stage.
By 1910, Paisley was home to the third largest company on the planet, second only to US Steel and Standard Oil, with factories in around 40 countries.
People travelled all over the world, literally, for Coates.
They were dominant in Russia. They were becoming dominant in Europe. And by about the middle 1930s, they had 35,000 employees worldwide.
When Coates started to manufacture overseas, what was done in Paisley was copied by everybody else, so that Paisley remained the engine that drove everything.
With mills in locations as far-flung as El Salvador, Japan, India, and Russia, Coates employees were travelling far and wide to train foreign workers long before the advent of aviation.
If you were wanting to see the world, the two quickest options if you were a Paisley buddy were to join the army or join Coates. A large number of Paisley people went out there from the mills in Paisley, right down to mill girl level, because nobody had worked in a thread mill before.
that changed their lives quite dramatically, I would think, you know, because they saw a totally different world.
A plane takes off.
We were kind of put in the sausage machine for being sent somewhere, and somewhere could be anywhere. And I was eventually sent to Brazil.
3.5 years after I started, I headed off to my first job, which was in Peru.
My first real job was in Colombia, South America.
I got sent for to personnel and said, would you like to go to Peru? The biggest change was the food. You don't ask what it is, you just eat it and enjoy it.
We arrived just at the start of the 1970 World Cup, and we were billeted in a hotel downtown. And of course, Brazil was sensational in that World Cup and won it. And the whole city erupted into a 3-day carnival.
You would go Glasgow, London, London, Madrid.
Madrid to Lisbon, Lisbon to Dakar.
Caracas, Bogota.
Cartagena to Quito.
Quito, Guayaquil, Guayaquil, Lima. So that it was a real hoppity-hop kind of journey.
34 and a half hours. Every time we landed, we were given a wee ticket to go and get a drink.
It was an interesting culture because they still spoke elements of Paisley on the mill floor, and words survived into the local argot, like Nyafi turns out to be a foreman, as a wee nyaf.
Working abroad, Coates' employees often got caught up in life-changing world events.
Working in South America was an interesting experience. In Venezuela, we had two military coups while we were there. I can remember the personnel manager calling me up at 4 o'clock in the morning and saying, don't be alarmed, but there is a coup going on at the moment. Stay at home and wait till I call you.
My grandfather had worked in the mill. He was a foreman. At the turn of the century, he was actually sent to Russia. They were opening a mill there.
My mother had an aunt, and she was what they called a mistress, but that's a teacher, you know. And she was in the Russian mills out there. And she had to, they had all to pack very quickly when the revolution started.
They lost the Russian mills and the revolution. They lost Poland, Estonia, Latvia, France, Germany, Italy, Spain because of the Civil War.
During the war, they lost complete contact with all the mills in Eastern Europe and in Germany and Austria. And a lot of them were actually converted to making product for the German army.
A passport belonging to Mr. W. Matheson.
Well, these are the pre-war passports of my father, covering the years 1935 to 1948.
Ken's father, Willie Matheson, worked for Coates all his life. Starting as an office junior at the age of 13, he worked his way up through the ranks and ended up travelling the world as a cost accountant, visiting around 30 countries in his career.
In those days, you went in or out of a country and you got your passport stamped. He was hardly in any one location or any one country for more than 3 weeks.
In the mid-1930s, Willie Matheson was sent to install a standard costing system in the mills of Eastern Europe.
My father was based near Vienna, where the Austrian mills were, and he was doing the installation of the system in Austria, Czechoslovakia and Bratislava. So my father was in and out of Germany a lot. So he saw life in under the Nazis in Germany.
On the 12th of March 1938, German tanks rolled into Vienna.
The day that he was told to get out of Bratislava and Vienna and come home was the day that Hitler actually arrived in Vienna.
Hitler stands in the front seat of an open-top car and waves to a huge crowd.
My father got a taxi to the street where they lived, and it was a little cul-de-sac of flats, and there were swastika banners hanging off all of the balconies, except their flat, which was hanging with my brother's nappies. So it was get those down right away, pack what you can get, and left everything else.
The motorcade continues.
They drove through the streets ahead of the Hitler's procession, and the streets were thronged with thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and they were driving down the route of the motorcade just in time to get away with it. That's what they saw coming out of Austria that day.
Operating abroad was challenging, particularly during times of conflict. But Coates had been smart, and although they lost Mills during the Second World War, they managed to get back on their feet pretty quickly.
Coates had been really brilliant at looking after their proprietorial rights, you know, their trademarks, their patents, their title deeds, everything that proved their ownership of property in a particular country.
By a lot of judicious hiding of things, they actually managed to get back up and running quite quickly.
They got out of Hungary and Czechoslovakia, for instance, with all of their title deeds, all of their property things. They actually got themselves back in the game in a lot of countries where they had basically written it all off.
A photo of one of the mills, then of a group of female workers. In a cafe in present-day Paisley...
That hour before you started was crucial because the kids had to be home prompt. They were changed out the school uniforms, the homework was started.
Well, you'd outside stairs to scrub as well, and you'd put your chalk down the side of your clothes.
What year was that?
She's older
than that. But there was a good social side to working in the mill because there was always somebody had a catalogue going, an Avon book, Minogi's. There was Minogi's running. It was quite a good social scene.
In a strict working environment where men ruled the roost, there was one place where the women were in charge.
On a Friday especially, it was a different day for the ladies because that was the day the weekend was looming. So they disappeared, and when I first started, I used to wonder where they all went. But they were all in the toilets getting their hair done.
The atmosphere in the place was brilliant. When it came the weekend, we were all ready to go out finishing a Friday. We went out in the cloakroom, we were getting our hair done. We were getting our eyebrows plucked already and my rollers in already for the weekend experience and the dancing and all that. I mean, it was great.
You could get your hair cut in the toilet. Was this girl, in this particular day, going out, everybody's shouting, the machines all went off. They went, good night, Willie, and he said, aye, and forgot to get the rest of your hair cut. She'd forgot when she was walking out. She'd get the right side cut, which was into the machines, but when she came out, it was a... She'd forgot the opposite side.
A series of photos of female mill workers.
So you'd be in the toilets and you'd say, are you going to Barrowland this week? Yes, I am. Days a favour. Going to show us how to do the creep. And this was, you did two steps to that side, two steps to that side. And then you dragged your right leg. So it looked as if you had a bad leg, so it was called the creep. So this was you in the toilets and you were dancing and showing them a new thing about the creep, or else it was a twist and whatever it was. They had such a lot of dance halls in Paisley. So it didn't matter where you went in Paisley, there was always a mill girl.
The town was buzzing with all these people working, and they had a lot of money to spend.
Footage of people dancing, then the mill building with its towering chimney, a church spire against a cloudy sky.
Paisley has the second lowest level of unemployment in Scotland. Only oil and fish-rich Aberdeen can employ more of its people.
In the 1960s, Paisley was thriving. As well as the thread mills, other big employers included the Hillman car factory at Linwood, and food producers, Brown and Paulson.
Paisley was a good going town at that time because there was a lot of money. Paisley girls were always well dressed.
Oh, Paisley was great. Paisley in the 60s and that was superb. And it was just a place to be.
People would come on holiday Mondays from Glasgow to Paisley because it was such a good place to shop.
Good quality gents shops that a lot of my generation will remember. There was John Collier's, there was Hepworth's, there was Burton's, there was Jackson's.
There'd be a furniture shop, maybe bicycles. There was that right along.
A printing press.
Industry had allowed the town to flourish. But by the 70s, like the rest of industrial Scotland, Paisley was in decline. The car plant at Linwood had begun laying off thousands of workers and would eventually close. There were many more job losses on the horizon, and the mills were not immune.
Somewhere about the 50s into the 60s, there was a kind of a personnel edict that top-level management would be recruited from universities rather than through the traditional mill pattern where the bright folk in the mill could actually progress. That stifled people who actually knew how to make thread from getting to the positions of managing a mill that makes thread.
I don't know who the managers in the top brass were, in quotes, you know, after a time.
Times had changed, and the family were no longer the major shareholders in the company. Global capitalism had sent textiles in Britain into a downward spiral, and Paisley would be hit hard.
Through the 20s and 30s, coats developed hugely in Europe. Through the 50s and early 60s, coats developed hugely in Latin America. So the potential for export from Paisley was being undermined.
So the ethos of the company had completely changed from being about locations and loyalties as well as profitability to being about the maximisation of profit.
Paisley High Street.
Coats had been pioneers of globalised working, manufacturing abroad long before it was a norm. For their Paisley workforce, the years of exporting their skills overseas was about to backfire.
That's just been the effects of sort of globalisation, in the sense that it became cheaper to move production abroad. And I mean, the whole of Scotland suffered.
I always felt that's what killed the mills, because they were making it cheaper abroad.
Well, this is what I was thinking. If they're taking the machines over to there instead of sending their cotton stuff to us, we're not going to have a mill.
Coats had begun buying up other textile companies, joining with familiar names such as Viella and Paton's, in an attempt to maximise profits and at the same time create work for the town which had made their fortune. But it was to be in vain.
The actual mill buildings were 19th century buildings. Fast forward 100 years and they're kind of not fit for purpose.
Because of the demise of the domestic business, it became clear that this huge Paisley engine couldn't be fed.
It was imploding in on itself, and it became obvious after a time that something had to be closed, and indeed Fergusley was the first place to go.
In December 1983, the vast Fergusley mills were closed for good, and the once 10,000-strong workforce had now shrunk to around a fifth of that size. The workers who kept their jobs were moved to the mills at Anchor.
There was always a big meeting of the managers every year to see how the company was doing. And that was followed by a meeting of the assistant managers. And I think there was about 18 of us all went to a meeting, and this director, you know, good morning, how are you? Nothing was said. He went through all the figures, no questions. And we just walked out. And the following months, we got redundancies.
How did you feel?
Rotten.
The worst moment of my life was the time when Fergusley shut. Fergusley, I kind of grew up there. I was 15 till I was 40.
When we were told that the mall was closing down, I was crying. You think your life's over when it closes down, you know what I mean? You thought, well, what am I going to do now?
I was told I would be made redundant in 18 months. And I was literally kind of last in situ in Fergusley Mills.
I was 38 when I was made redundant, and I felt demoralised, totally demoralised.
I actually did hand over the cheques to a lot of them, you know. I mean, one day, I remember, I think it was about 40 men went out of gas, a dyer, and you knew a lot of them would never get a job for ages, if at all, you know. You went home and felt like hitting your head off the wall. You know, it was really, really good to you.
Everybody was a bag of nerves. What happened was you'd get a phone call saying, come in a certain day and date it, and you'll know your fate. And he took us in one at a time, like an execution, and he told us individually, you've got a job, you've no got a job. And some took it really bad, kicking chairs and what have you. And so when I got called in, I was told, luckily I had a job, you know. And they, of course, they were asking me, and they're saying congratulations, but probably saying, no, that's one less.
It was a sad, sad feeling. I mean, I remember when I was leaving, where I was with some of the people I worked with. It was quite emotional.
And I remember the last day I was there, I got to the top of the flat, and I opened the door and I stood and I looked back and I went away, and that was the beginning of the end.
An eerie photo of the abandoned, empty building is contrasted with an image of the mill at the height of its operation.
Those of us who were involved in the organisation of it, I think, would say we did as much as we could.
Suppose they held on to hope that Anchor would still survive, and it always rang in my ears when we were told we're getting a job in Anchor. Guys in Ferguson were saying, ah, you'll no last 10 years. And that's exactly how long it did last, 10 years.
Fergusley's closure was to be a portent of things to come.
Ultimately, the decision had to be taken. You know, really, there isn't a long-term future for Paisley.
Redundancies had continued, and by the early 1990s, the workforce left at Anchor had dwindled to just a few hundred people. The decision was finally made to close the last of the Paisley thread mills.
From being a 15-year-old coming out of school and not really knowing what work was all about, I ended up more or less putting out the lights in Anchor Mills.
It was such a big operation in Paisley. The whole town at that time was kind of largely dependent on Coats.
A lot of the wee bleach works and dye works up the road, they all closed.
On a Friday, one of the girls would buy cream cookies, and that was your Friday treat. So that wee, they wee Williams bakers all shot.
I mean, Coats' name wasn't good then.
The mill's chimney stack bathed in warm sunlight against a clear blue sky.
Today, Coats PLC is still the world's largest thread manufacturer, with huge modern factories all over the world, but none in the UK. The area of Fergusley in Paisley, once the engine that drove the world's third largest company, is now the poorest in Scotland.
The first demolition I ever saw in the mills was in Anchor, and it went down in the early 70s. Oh, that was terrible, because at one point a part happened to pass, and I saw, you know, half of it was down, and it was just so sad.
As the organisation had shrunk, one by one, buildings had disappeared. In 1992, the most iconic of them all, the number one spinning mill at Fergusley, was scheduled for demolition.
Fergusley Mill, to me, was absolutely stunning, a stunning building. We'll never see the likes of that again.
A series of photos of Fergusile Mill in its prime, the gatehouse with its clock tower, the half-time school, and the expansive mill complex. Images of people at work in the mill, then groups of female workers happily posing. Andy Glassford, Turner's assistant.
Fergusley Mill's where I work. You're walking through there now, and all you see is houses. Now that's a place where 3,000 or 4,000 people used to work. 3,000 or 4,000 families that depended on the income.
A photo of the main mill building. Diggers methodically demolish the mill and reduce it to a pile of rubble. A large section of the front of the building collapses to the ground.
Everybody was standing crying. We're all getting pulled down. I think Paisley people felt pulled down. And I remember standing there and my dad said, well, that's it. Life in Paisley is starting to go downhill.
Another part of the building crashes to the ground and sends dust and debris flying. An aerial view of present-day Paisley, then the exterior of the Anchor Bar.
I've been coming to Paisley for nearly 30 years to work, and I get a very intense feeling of something old, venerable and useful having gone.
I'm a Paisley person, and I always will be, but I can't say I'm proud of what the town has become.
But you just felt it was part of Paisley that had gone, and it had gone forever, that it was never going to come back.
Debris from the crumbling building cascades down, then pigeons are startled from their perch. The four friends are still chatting in the cafe.
Well, you take it, or look at how they've built all the houses where the mill used to be. I know.
They did abandon us because I thought when my lassies grew up, my lassies were getting to the mill, and by the time they had grown up, Berkeley Mills was shut.
They should have kept that building.
Davy, how are you?
What job?
You're kind of late, Mr. McNamara.
What job? You don't change that much.
Well, I haven't criticised you at all.
You know, I know. Yeah, good to see you, gorgeous.
David was a very popular mill foreman at Fergusley for 25 years and is remembered fondly by these workers.
Everybody going great and, oh, well, there were differences, of course, you know, but you had your social life. I get people sometimes come up to me and say, you played at my wedding. I says, oh, did I? She says, did you not remember me? I says, why, you were the one with the white dress, wasn't you? But you had so many laughs and it was a way of life.
And I appreciate the fact that it was built in Paisley and gave us all work and all sorts of jobs for lots of people, because, gosh, we miss them now.
Yeah, this is a cheery meeting today.
Yes,
yes.
Should have come to Dermot. Should have come to Dermot and heard us talk about it.
Really funny. I was lucky that I stayed on in the mills and I have had a great life in the mills, and I met a lot of great people in the mills.
It was very much a family sort of feel. I've got friends still that I worked beside all these years ago.
I enjoyed the mill, had a good living from it, and the mill was good to me.
The people in Paisley are still great descendants of these mill workers and Coates people.
Paisley was in the mills. Still is. I wouldn't leave it.
Footage of people at work in the mill.
It's as well to remember our history, even the murkier bits. Maybe it's not the stuff of kings and wars and high affairs of state. Maybe it has more to do with bobbins and mill girls and men standing for what they believed in. And there can be pride in that too. For it is the history of the people of Paisley. The people who made Paisley the town that it is. One of the most uniquely independent and successful towns Scotland has ever produced. The place to keep your eye on.
The footage is projected onto the walls of one of the surviving mill buildings.